I would like to open with a story, and like many stories, I don't actually know how true it is, but there's value in the story. A woman in a supermarket is following a grandfather and his 3-year-old grandson. It's obvious to her that he has his hands full with the child screaming for candy when they get to the candy aisle. When they get to the cookie aisle, he's screaming for the cookies. Meanwhile, Granddad is working his way around, saying in a controlled voice, "Easy, William. We won't be long. Easy, boy." They get to the cereal aisle, another outburst, and she hears the grandfather calmly say, "It's okay, William. Just a couple more minutes and we'll be out of here. Hang in there, boy." At the checkout, the boy is throwing items out of the cart. The granddad says again in a very controlled voice, William, relax, buddy. Don't get upset. We'll be home in 5 short minutes. Stay cool, William." Very impressed, the woman goes outside where the grandfather is loading his groceries and the boy into the car. She says to the elderly gentleman, "It's none of my business, but you were amazing in there. I don't know how you did it. The whole time you kept your composure, and no matter how loud and disruptive he got, you just calmly kept saying things would be okay. William is very lucky to have you as his grandpa." "Thanks," the man said. "My name is William." So this man, we can say, was practicing self-control, self-restraint, moderation. And that is the topic that I want to explore today. I believe it is a worthwhile topic because when I scan the many essential truths that are taught by so many world religions, it shows up as one of them. And when I thought through what we've discussed from the pulpit in the last few years, I thought this would be a good one to bring to the light. So let's start by looking at some commonly known restraints encouraged by some religions. This is really just a random sampling from my brain. So the LDS Church, the Latter-day Saints, whom other people call Mormons, discourage their practitioners from drinking caffeinated drinks. The Catholic religion discourages practitioners from sex before marriage. That's also encouraged by the LDS Church. Part of the Hindu teaching from the ancient texts is not to steal, not to take another person's possessions. That self-restraint is also encouraged by Christianity. Judaism discourages practitioners from working on the Sabbath. That's also encouraged by the Seventh-day Adventists. So those are just a very random small sampling of some general rules. Now, I'm going to venture a guess that those guidelines were created by a person in a position of authority because they thought they would be good for individuals or good for the religious group or society trying to live together. Now, it is absolutely true that sometimes people in religious authority create rules for their own good or as a power play. But right now, I'm going with the general theory that most religions are pointing to some universal wisdom when they encourage self-restraint. The question then becomes, which of the restraints are life-giving? And to answer that question, I think we need to consider individual contexts, because each person comes to this exploration of self-control from a different place. Indeed, as each of you are listening, I'm guessing some of you are feeling wary, and some of you may feel eagerly curious. Each person comes to this exploration with a different background. A person born with a carefree temperament has a different disposition than a person who was born more naturally cautious. If you were raised in a rule-centered household, you probably have a different outlook than a person who was raised in a more loose household. A person living with an addiction may bring a different perspective than a person who is not. A person who has been labeled ADHD may have insights about freedom and creativity that are not visible to others. A person who has been labeled OCD may desire to be free of too much internal control. So these are just some of the many angles that different people may bring to the question of self-restraint. So let me offer an example of a person who chose to limit himself for spiritual reasons. So this example comes from a Unitarian Universalist minister. What I'm going to share, he wrote in 2006. It was published in the magazine called the UU World Magazine. At that time, he was serving a congregation in Florida, and I'm not sure where he's serving now. He identifies as a Unitarian Hindu. In this essay, he's discussing his choice to fast, and by fasting I mean refraining from eating, during the month of Ramadan, which is a Muslim month of observance. He's not Muslim, but he's decided to engage in this practice. Here is what he wrote. "I am fasting for myself, for my own spiritual growth, to make more room for God. I want to deepen or reawaken my sense of the spirit by letting go of my cravings for good food. My hunger will be a visceral reminder of my own deepest yearnings. As a Unitarian Universalist, I believe in the primacy of reason, conscience, and freedom. And I know that the biggest obstacle standing in the way of my living freely, reasonably, and compassionately is my own ego, selfishness, and unquenchable desire. I have tended to fill my spiritual hunger with food and drink, with material comforts and stuff, with tasks, with distractions like television." And so he's describing there a personal choice to practice self-restraint and moderation. He knows that it's not prescribed to him religiously because he's not Muslim, but he's coming alongside his neighbors out of curiosity. So that's just one person's example of how they intentionally chose to practice self-control as a spiritual practice, drawing on a tradition from a religious heritage. So I believe that self-control is a lifelong learning. So there he was as an adult. He's continuing to learn and experiment. So I think this example helps us see the principle that if a person is to learn self-restraint, they need to experiment with limits, even starting in childhood. So consider the fact that children learn limits through experimentation. When learning to ride a bike, at first, they may not be able to balance, but eventually, they learn how much effort to apply to be stable, how much arm strength is needed with each arm, how much do their legs need to hug into the center of the bike, how much core strength do they need. I don't think they call it core strength when they're learning to ride a bike. But it goes even further than that. I have heard a story, this was told to me by an elderly woman that I know elsewhere, and she recalls a family that she knew when she was a child many decades ago. In that family, only the boys were allowed to have bicycles. One of the sisters in the family was envious of her brother's bicycle. So in a fit of desire and courage, when the family wasn't looking, she grabbed her brother's bike. She hopped on. She figured out how to get stable and ride. She was seeking the freedom and the fun of the ride. And only then did she realize she did not know how to use the brakes. So this is a metaphor for many things in life, many learnings that we have at many stages. In addition to this physical learning, children have opportunities to learn about emotional self-control, when to put the brakes on their anger or to redirect it, when to put the brakes on affection if the affection is leading to a problem. In addition to learning about physical and emotional self-control, children have opportunities to learn mental self-control. Mental self-control can mean focusing on a project enough to accomplish a goal, but not to be so focused for so long that one exhausts oneself. So these are principles that children work on, but in so many stages of our life, we continue to learn them. And the world around us changes. Just as in learning the balance of riding a bike, we need a lifelong spiritual practice, finding calibration again and again. Technology will continue to change, and the self-control that helped you if you lived in the age before cell phones may not help you now. So this wisdom is borne out that there is a book published. So an author felt enough motivation to write a book. A publisher felt enough promise that it would sell that they published it. And it is called Outsmart Your Smartphone: Conscious Tech Habits for Finding Happiness, Balance, and Connection. So this author is positing that if a person starts with their values, including kindness and gratitude, and then uses their phone to live out those, or if they find their purpose in life first and then use their phone to support that, and then are present for each moment they're using the phone, that they're going to end up more in line with their values at the end. So this book is just one of the many examples of how we need to be constantly updating our brains as the environment and tools around us change. So I'm positing here that self-control is valid when it points to the values that we want to live out. So let's take another example of money. So money is useful to buy certain items that are needed. If we only buy what we feel like buying in the moment, we might end up later discovering that we don't have the money that we need for our long-term goals. So I've seen it put on a bell curve that at first a person needs enough money for survival. At some point, if they have more, it can allow them to spend for comforts. Then with a little bit more money, they could say they have enough. They've covered survival, comforts, contributing to community, and that's enough. And in this model of the bell curve, then the person descends down that more spending is overconsumption. It's no longer helping them be who they are truly. And so this illustrates that there's a spectrum in which we find balance. Now let's take that example a little bit further. If a person becomes bogged down by grief, by low self-esteem, by some other emotional hardship, they might try to fix that unhappiness by buying more things to make them happy. In other words, we can get out of balance. This is an age-old concept. It's a concept that was found over 2,000 years ago in the ancient yoga teachings, and a modern yoga teacher from India who grew up studying these ancient texts, he explains it this way for modern listeners. He says, and this is, I'm quoting from B.K.S. Iyengar, he says, owing to desires, anger, greed, infatuation, arrogance, and jealousy, the mind can become engulfed in pain. Misled by these emotions, a person can lose his balance of mind and behave unethically. So isn't it true that sometimes in life we reach a spot when we think that our heartache will have no end? Sometimes we have big questions that lead to a crisis of hope. Sometimes we are not sure who we are anymore. And at those times, in desperation, we might accidentally look for a big fix or a big cover-up. We might lose sight of the fact that a small adjustment will help and that we don't need a big leap. Let us consider that framework on a broader level, expanding from individual use of resources to how a whole society uses resources. On a global scale, what would self-control mean? This question is becoming more and more urgent as we experience heightened climate change. This week, the Washington Post published photos of new erosion in Siberia, where global warming is happening at a rate faster than anywhere else on Earth. And as we sit here this morning, over in Japan, they are suffering from the strongest typhoon in many decades. Climate change may leave you with fear. Climate change may leave you with anger. Climate change may leave you with grief. It leaves many people without homes or lives. But what each of us can do is start from right where we are right now and look for solutions. Some people say that climate change cannot be solved by individuals, but only by government regulations or corporations. I believe that many levels of action are needed, and the self-control needs to be on individual, corporate, and government levels, taking the long-term perspective and being values-based. There is a common adage that less can be more. Many decades ago, a book was published called Progress as If Survival Mattered. There is another common adage, to live simply that others may simply live. The ability to practice moderation can come from the knowledge that our actions in this moment can help or harm another person elsewhere or in the future. Again, this can be known on a global scale or on a very personal, intimate scale. A woman who is pregnant may be motivated by wanting the baby to develop in a certain way, in a healthy way, and may make certain food choices or avoid certain substances during the pregnancy. So the motivation for self-control is for the desire for another person to be well. I've heard of that extending where a woman is pregnant, she's making choices for the baby, and then the woman's partner makes similar choices to support her. And so this leads us on to one possible solution, which is to be in a supportive environment, to surround yourself with people who share your values enough to help you do the behaviors that will help you live your values. And yet, isn't it true that even with the best intent, sometimes we do go too far and cause harm to individuals? And in that case, what can we do? Well, this month, the Jewish community has been observing Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. This is a time when they reflect on actions in the past year and try to figure out what they can do to make up, to make well, and to go forward. This week, our church building was rented by one of the local Jewish groups, and they were having their beautiful music and meditations on the labyrinth and in the social hall. Later in the service, I'm going to invite you into a reading inspired by Yom Kippur, which helps us reflect on forgiveness and beginning again. And so this business of beginning again and again throughout life, learning again and again throughout life about self-control, it's about being on a spectrum and figuring out for ourselves as individuals in each situation where to be on that spectrum. So I'd like to offer a metaphor of a cobblestone pathway. A cobblestone pathway is not like a smooth, paved sidewalk. In a cobblestone path, some of the stones are large, some are small. Most are rounded, with uneven spaces in between. A person cannot walk along that path with the same sized, even, regulated steps. They need to be able to adjust, to take big steps over the uneven places and little steps when the smooth stones are close together. Perhaps you've seen a child learning to walk on cobblestones, adjusting their stride. Or perhaps you have experienced a challenge in your own walking sometime, and you know the struggle of needing to make your legs work to adjust to uneven footing. The control over one's leg muscles gives one stability and hence safety from falling. And this can be a metaphor. A person is not guaranteed to walk through life on smooth surfaces. There will be times when the path is uneven. And so it is with our emotional and mental landscapes. We need the capacity to adjust to the big or little movements so that we have inner stability. We cannot be guaranteed an outer environment of ease at all times. Here is the human truth. We do not have control over what happens. Seasons come and go. Lives begin and end. Emotions rise and fall. Thoughts come and go. But we do have control over behaviors, and perhaps this is ultimately what saves us. Is that possible that that's what saves us? And does this perhaps bring us full circle back to the original question of why religions would encourage self-control and moderation? Most religions are trying to point people towards a source of freedom. In the most basic level, a religion is saying, follow certain guidelines and experience freedom as a result. In a more complex mystical level, most religions are saying, on the deep meditative path, you experience freedom. So by observing our behaviors and controlling them, we may experience a new kind of freedom, a paradox. In a moment, if we want a small freedom, perhaps we can practice moderation and opt for a larger freedom. There is a doctor who identifies himself as living with ADHD. He was asked to write about his experience of his spiritual life, and he told about his favorite prayer, which goes like this: Lord, help me always to search for the truth, but spare me the company of those who have found it. So, in closing, my friends, self-control is not a set thing. It is a moving, living, thriving, dynamic experience. May all of us be fully alive and awake in this seeking. Blessed be. Amen. Let us reflect in silence together.